have to love the kids and you have to love being with the kids.
This is the second time Christy's come. We came once before. We had a beautiful conversation. It was fantastic. And I'd almost like to put that clip of the beginning of how I introduced Christy, who I had on. She was number 16 of my podcast. I think you're going to be 320 in this one.
Okay.
Between this time.
That's
and
amazing.
Christy admitted that being behind cameras isn't necessarily her favorite thing to do, but she said, it's a challenge and I love challenges, so I'm going to go for it. But we had a very good conversation, mm-hmm. I really do. But it wasn't appropriate for what we're trying to do now. What we're going to do now is talk about education. I think we should talk about education. And the reason why you probably have some of the feelings that I might even put in at the beginning how we were talking about teaching is because you grew up on a campus.
Mm-hmm.
You watched both of your parents doing exactly that. And I think, and you've obviously turned out okay.
Thanks.
You know, look at it. Because the way that you handle people, you have to like yourself in order to like other people's people, you know. And I think you had a very good emotional time in school. Everything I hear from you.
Yeah, no, I loved school. And I think looking back, my mom was a teacher, principal, administrator, superintendent. She taught summer schools. I was always on campuses, kind of like I explained, I grew up on campuses. And my mom was a really amazing mentor person. I didn't realize it at the time, she was just mom. But how she cared for all of her students, for all of her colleagues, how she asked questions and didn't judge, how she explored different ways to make things possible. And I think how she connected with parents as well. I kind of learned this when I was in high school. My ninth grade year, she was the assistant principal. And so this was a public school. And so I was hearing stories from my friends whose older brothers or sisters might be getting in trouble or having to go to the office. And there was such respect for her interactions, even if a student was in trouble or had done something wrong or made a bad choice. She always treated the students with respect, trying to understand what happened, why, where were those decision points in your life or in this moment that led to this path? What can you do differently? And conversations with the parents were the same. And so I was able to hear.
But how were you able to hear these? Because she'd come home and kind of talk about the situation, not knowing who the person was.
No, I would hear from younger. So if I was in ninth grade, one of my classmates' older brothers or sisters might have gotten in trouble. And
right.
So I would hear from them what was happening. Because, you know, there's always this fear of, they've been sent to the office. Let's see what's going to happen. And then they would tell me about, wow, your mom is so cool. Like, she talked to my brother about this. She called home and talked to my mom and dad, or they came in to see her. And at the time, I when you grow up on campuses, you know to kind of steer clear of that overlap. And so we didn't really talk about specifics at home. But later on, when I moved into education, because it was a shift, we talked more about situations and approaches.
How old were you when you made that shift?
Oh, not till I was 30. I mess up my years. 37, 38?
And then
late 30s.
Then you'd actually call your mother.
Yeah. I call my mom every day. Every morning. I'd talk to her and just kind of.
How old is she now? How old is she now?
She's 75, 76.
And your dad is still alive. I have to remember. He passed, right?
He passed. Yeah.
And they stayed together until?
I was seven.
Okay.
Yeah, and then they separated.
Was
but
you really?
Very close, amicable relationship.
Right.
And we were always together. I mean, we lived in the same town, and my dad would pick me up after school, and we'd go play softball. He
and
was my
neither
coach.
One of them had, I mean, of course, your mother didn't have any more kids, and your father didn't.
Oh, no, they both did.
They did?
They both remarried.
But you're the only child between the two of them.
I'm the only child between
the two
of them.
That's right, and they treated you as such.
Yeah.
Right.
And they remarried later on when I was about 12, and then, I was already kind of middle school, high school age. Right. And then they each had another another baby. So I have a right. younger brother and a younger sister.
Okay.
And the age difference is really fun. Because it's such an age difference. One's 12 years younger, my sister is 12 years younger, and my brother is 18 years younger.
Wow.
And so it's such a great relationship because of that age difference. There's mm-hmm. no, I think sometimes when you are a child of divorced families, like you read the statistics and there's that potential for having a difficult childhood, and I didn't have it. And at the time, it just all seemed normal and great and fun. And I didn't realize until later how important their friendship was and their determination to create a normal, happy childhood.
Right, right.
And that goes back to, I think, the importance of relationships with schools and parents, and how you shape those early memories and experiences for a child,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
just what that builds for them in terms of
right.
their resilience, identity, their ability to face life and start their own journey.
Right, right.
Yeah, so I was really lucky.
And that's why you're able to push that out so easily to the kids that are around you now.
Yeah.
It's almost what you expect. It's
you gotta love what you do.
Don't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you don't, you at least should be good at it. Whatever you do.
That's a dangerous one, right? If you're
really
good at what you do, but you don't love what you do, it's easy to become, I think, a bit cynical.
Cynical. I think so. But I've talked to some business people.
Yeah.
And it's like a necessary...
Evil.
Yeah. Maybe you could think of it that way, but they don't love it, but they're very good at it.
Yes.
And they're people that you wouldn't want to have anywhere else other than that field, if they're accountants or if they're, you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Or they're lawyers or whatever. They may not love it, but they're very good at it.
Very good at
it. And they're not afraid to tell you that.
And I hope that they're able to find satisfaction and joy in something else.
They do, usually in their hobbies. That's
right?
Where they,
yeah.
they go to that, but they go back to where they have to go through this stuff that they're extremely good at.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, they don't have that passion for it
yeah.
that some people think you'd need to have to be really good. That's not necessarily
true. It depends on the industry.
You know what I mean? Right.
If you aren't thriving on relationships and connections, if that's not a core part of what you do professionally, then being good at something but not loving it is okay, because you're really good at a process or moving something toward an outcome, and you're not impacting other people in a way that you might that's in an industry that's more relationship based.
But I think let's play this a little bit,
yeah.
because I think you're right. However, I think that all industries are relationship based, even if you're dealing with just one other person. And I've seen so many people in professional positions, just in the other way. So, well, I mean, goes well where you find someone that loves what they're doing, and they're really outgoing, social, and very considerate of your feelings. Then you have people that are in high power position, or just positions. They could be a clerk behind the counter, and they're not pleasant ever. You seem to always catch them on their bad day. You know what I mean? You want to think they're happy somewhere, but they're just not showing that to you. And I know some people in political positions that you wish they weren't the person you had to come in contact with, but they represent too much for you not to, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And we've all seen that happen. And they might be good at what they're doing, however, they're not as social as they need to be, as I would think they should be.
Yeah, then I guess it goes deeper to a sense of not only loving what you do, but how do you frame your role and responsibility to others?
So how do you?
Is it an honor? Is it a privilege?
Right.
Is it a responsibility that is more than transactional? And maybe that's as you're describing those situations. If you look at things from a transactional standpoint, then your focus is on that interaction.
Only. Right.
If you're
not the repercussions.
Yeah.
Not the.
If your focus is relation-based or relational, and you're thinking more deeply about what is the feeling that I want this person to have, because they have come into contact with me, or like you said, with the club, with the organization, then you put a different part of yourself into each moment, each interaction, right. And it comes across as very naturally. And it's interesting, you wonder, like, where does that come from?
Where does it come from for you? What do you do, how do you talk to your teachers about that, or how do you deal with it at school? How do you deal with the parents? How do you deal with the students? What thoughts go through your mind?
Well, gosh, with children, we're making a lasting imprint on their lives. So, and it's not the moments that, I think we think about schools as being about moving through the grade levels, doing well on certain tests or certain sports. We look at it as an achievement-based system. But in the lifespan, it's a very small number of years, right? But the imprint that school makes on a child sets them up for the rest of their lives. And the imprints come from the interactions, the way a person might respond, an adult might respond if you've made a mistake or done something wrong or messy, the way an adult might step in if there's a conflict or if you're sad. Those little moments imprint on you. Have I done something wrong? Is there something wrong with me? Or does someone recognize that I have a big feeling and help me understand not only what I'm feeling, but how to move through it? Does someone look at my strengths and say, and help me find value in my strengths and build on those, as opposed to looking at what's wrong with what I'm doing and trying to fix it? And so with our team, what I always check myself on is, what's the lasting memory, feeling, emotion that this experience is going to leave with a child? And it's not about how quickly, you know, in early years we're really focused on emergent literacy. It's not how quickly a child masters their letters or letter sound connections or numbers. It's how do they feel about each of those experiences? Because once you recognize that you can learn, oh, then you can learn. So, but if you don't have all of your letters and sounds by the time you're four, there's two ways to look at that. Something's wrong, let me put you in tutoring so that you can learn them faster. Or, wow, you've already mastered these 10. That's so cool. How did you do that? How did you figure out that that shape is this letter? Right? It's so simple, but that same feeling of, wow, I can do this, then starts to extend as they get older into bigger things, deeper things, and it's that sense of confidence and identity that will get you through life.
Isn't it hard, though? I look at all the schools I've been at, and then I look at the administrators like you, the directors of the school, having to deal with not just these impressionable kids, but people that have already come in with an impression to teach them. And just because they have a degree doesn't mean they should be the people imprinting on these kids. And how is it easy to move them or get them or get, because I'm sure you have to sometimes just, I know from having so many instructors, there's times where I pull my hair out, but if I do it or show that I can do it better, it deflates one person's ego. Well, it might help this child, but it's like I want to scream, huh? Help! And when you're trying to give advice, you see the blank stare in that teacher's eye or something, like they don't get it. They've been damaged.
Yeah. I mean, teaching is such a challenge.
And teaching teachers or teaching, you're talking from their viewpoint?
From there, being a teacher.
Okay, right.
When you think about the classroom, and I can't remember the name of the studies, but there was a study on the number of decisions and interactions that a teacher has in a day, and it's right up there with like air traffic controllers and surgeons. You're going, you know, you've got 15, 20 kids in a classroom and things are happening and you're making split-second decisions. So it can be stressful. We are so fortunate. Our team is very, very strong. And when I think about why that is, you need to have teachers who love what they do. They find joy in watching and learning together with the kids, right? There's magic in that moment of, oh, yes, you did see something. Let's look at it together. As opposed to the teacher that says, oh, that's great, but right now we need to go do something else because that's what the schedule is telling us to do. And sometimes that's coming from the individual. Sometimes it's coming from the environment or structures we put around the individual. If the bell's going to ring, you have no choice but to say, sorry, that's really interesting, but let's go. So I always try to find teachers who love discovery, who are curious, and they see the magic in wonder and exploration. And so they already have a predisposition to want to explore and learn together with the children.
Can you give me a secret as to how you do that? If you were interviewing me, what would I need to say or to display to you that you say, okay, he's got a job. I'll put him in here.
Stories. Tell me stories.
Okay, you'd ask me to tell you a story?
Yeah, I'd ask you to tell me stories about what you loved about school when you were growing up. What do you remember? What shaped who you are today? What are those lasting imprints that stayed with you? Okay. People who loved school, or people who had a great relationship and mentor role model when they were growing up. And then I would move to outside of school. I always look for evidence of curiosity in someone's background. And it can be as kind of as blatant as someone who, I don't know, has a deep interest or collection of something and they're always digging deeper into it, or just someone who uses their time in different ways. Mm-hmm. And so it's really looking at who the person is, not necessarily what their resume says.
Okay, right. How long of a probation do you give? Because people can, sometimes they can be very good at interviews. They say some people interview very well.
Yeah.
They're very good at interviewing, but when it comes to the practice of actually doing what they say they're, or what they're aspiring to do, it doesn't quite match what they were talking about. Now, we've all been in situations like that. Not all of us, but let's say administrators have dealt with that at time to time.
In the past, I have had people who either didn't really like what they were doing or wanted to do it in a certain way. And that certain way was not the best practice for children. So it starts with conversations about specific moments. Let's revisit what I just saw. And always from benefit of, I always give the benefit of the doubt, because if I'm running around classrooms, I'm seeing a snapshot, right? You never know what you're walking into or what's gonna happen next unless you're there for the full day. So I always just start with a conversation, and then I turn it around and I'll say, well, as I was walking in, here's what I heard or here's what I saw. This is the impression that it gave me. How do you think children might have experienced that? Or if we had a parent walking by or a colleague, what might that have sounded like or looked like to that parent or that colleague? And so that's where I start from. And then we kind of work from there. And so we're really fortunate at school that all of our teachers are, as I said, they love what they do and they're really experienced. But not all schools have that benefit. And so I would then step back a little more and look at what that situation was. And part of this is a gut feel, right? Is this a personality challenge? Is this a practice challenge? Is this an issue of confidence? Is it environmental? And what I was talking about with the teacher who might rush a child through, I would say that's environmental, because we've set a schedule and a bell system that says, sorry, this group of kids needs to move. If it was personality driven, maybe that's a person who needs to recognize, oh, these are my triggers. If a child, I don't know, I know one of my triggers is if a child is rude.
What's rude to you?
Back talks, or says something mean. Okay. For no reason, or for what I perceive as no reason. This was a big learning for me, because I started in elementary school, and growing up, being rude was not allowed.
I mean, when I was growing up, certain facial expressions,
yes,
were not even allowed.
Yes, you were not allowed to roll your eyes.
Shoot. No, or look like you were upset.
Yes.
And if you didn't know what that meant, you found out real quick.
Yeah, so facial expressions,
they weren't accepted.
The one eyebrow raise, yeah. the rolling of eyes.
We knew better than to say anything. If you were, if you'd seen how they responded to someone else, you were fortunate enough to find out you didn't want to be the one that found that out.
Yeah. So when I started teaching, I found myself snapping back at kids if they said something that was rude, impolite, whether to me or to another child. My immediate response as a first-year teacher was, stop that, or let's look, what just happened? And I was too stern. And so I pulled back. I read a lot about how children experiment with language and experiment with positionality, with power. And when they're little, it starts. And now as I observe kids, it really starts in their four-year-old, five-year-old, six-year-old year.
Yes,
it's experimentation. And so it was an effort for me to step back and go, okay, I know from my own values how I feel about this, but in my role as a teacher and the adult who's there, how do I respond in these situations in a way that's going to help the child and is going to help me understand who that child is and where they're coming from and what led to that response, so that the next time they have different words that they can use, or they have a different perspective that they can take. And that taught me a lot, because that was me recognizing something and then doing my own research and learning and understanding child development.
Give me an example of how you did it. How did you change from that snap of don't do that? What did you change to if a child did say something rude to someone else or to you? What would you do?
Two things. One was a lot of reading. And the second was talking with other teachers who were, one, more experienced and who I respected. Teachers who I didn't see maybe snapping back at a child or scolding a child. So teachers that I respected. And then teachers at older and younger grades, because they saw that same developmental need in older and younger children. And when you piece all of that together, you really start to see the continuum of child development and how it looks in different children. The other amazing resource were our, in the States we would call them our special ed teachers. So they had a higher and different level of understanding of neurodiversity, and talking with them about what is it that is leading to a child's response. And they have such different understandings of children and interpretations. And you kind of pull all of that together and you just build a deeper awareness of a certain topic.
Okay, so give me a response then. The boys say something to each other, the girl.
I have a great one.
How'd you do? Okay, yeah.
And this one, so little kids can be mean, right? So lunchtime. This was in San Francisco. I overheard one of the kids saying, I'm not going to sit next to you. I don't like sitting next to you. Picked up their lunch and walked away. And that leaves one of the other children, of course, devastated, because they've sat down. Now they're sad. Me as first-year teacher would have gone and said, hey, that was me. You know, you go back, you sit, you be nice. We all have to get along together. Now, if that same thing happened, I would talk with the child, the one who left.
Right. First.
First. And so I just saw that you picked up and left. What happened? Why did you leave? Let's look at the effect it's having on the other child. I mean, different words, but let's look at what's happening. And notice the face or the behavior of the other child. And then try to understand what it is that forced this child to walk away. And then, okay, how can we change that? What can you say that will make you feel better about this and help the other child? So it could be they say mean things, or they're too loud, or I don't like the way that they spread out at the lunch table. So what you're doing here is you're helping a child learn that they don't have to just walk away. They can self-advocate. They can express what it is that's bothering them, and they can identify it. Because you think about later in life, if you just keep leaving situations that you don't like, I mean, if you're fortunate, you find new situations you like, but you're not in control. If you are able to identify what it is that you didn't like, then you're able to make that situation better. You can still walk away if you want, but you have a sense of peace and control with where you're going. So I would think, let's go back, let's talk about this. You didn't like the way that the child spreads out their things, or you don't like the way your friend yells in your ear during lunch. Let's talk to them. Maybe they don't realize it.
Now, you know what? Now, I just saw a situation happening. Now, I'm just playing devil's advocate, the same thing. Now, the other kid's upset, and when you try to bring that child back, this kid says, I don't want to be with her anymore. Mm. Now, what do you do?
Then let's talk about that, too.
So you say you can't go. She has to stay there.
Yeah. I think so often, the easy approach, this was a hard learning in, I think the easy approach is to force peace, or to allow the split. The really hard, time-consuming, deep work comes when you talk with the children about what it is they're feeling.
Okay, now you have administrative or structural limitations. The bell rings just at that time.
Yeah, so that's
now
where...
Now what do we do?
So that's where...
And you're the administrator looking at you. I'm looking at you now out there talking to them, but you're always doing that. You're always talking to the kids and trying to get them together.
You prioritize the kids. So on our campus, yes, we have to transition because we share the playground and we have different things. But when something arises, we make the time to talk with the kids. And you've seen our rooms, right?
I know
right?
exactly how it works.
So
yes.
We have our little benches outside the classrooms.
Yes. I've seen the teachers go out there with the kids, and they practice, and I go, whoa.
Right, and so you'll see
So who's because you have two teachers in each room.
Yeah.
So one will be still working with the kids, and the kids don't seem to mind it because they know that it might happen. And, you know, Karen's
and
always going out.
The critical thing is the kids know that they're not in trouble. It's not a punitive conversation. And I think that's really the important modeling for children, and also the guidance for them is you're coming at it from a point of curiosity. What just happened here? Help me explain. Let's go a little bit deeper. Social emotional understanding is so important, and if you don't teach kids the language to share what they're feeling, then they continue to go through life just knowing that, oh, this makes me uncomfortable, I don't know why, and I'm gonna leave. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, oh, what is this feeling I'm having? What's driving it? And can I address it? Because some things you can walk away from, some things you can't. So we make the time and flexibility in our, I would say in our school culture, to put children's needs first. So if something happens, even if the class is going down to the playground, a teacher will stay with the children to talk through it, and then they'll go down. And the reverse is true. We've had classes go up,
and the kids stay
and out. We keep a couple of kids together on the playground, or if it gets cold, they'll come in, and we'll talk about it in a kind of in a neutral setting, right? Not in the classroom, not where they've got an audience.
Right.
We'll sit outside on the bench. Sometimes they'll come to my office and we'll talk. Sometimes we'll sit on the playground, the curb. But really, it's about trying to get to that deeper feeling of what is it. And that's the lifelong learning that comes from those moments, is now you've empowered a child to be able to express what they're feeling or what they need. But also, the child who, let's call the offender, they might not know what they're doing.
Of course.
And they don't recognize the impact that it's having. Or they might think it's funny, and they don't realize it's only funny for some of their friends, but for some of their other friends, that's not so funny. And so that child, instead of feeling like people are walking away from me, now recognizes, oh, I'm in control of how I behave around different people. So it's a very empowering approach, but it takes time, and it takes, like I said, it takes a love of what you do, because it's easy to say, oh, let's just fix this problem. Okay, now let's get to what we need to be doing as a class.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's a challenge. So
it is. It is.
Those are the types of questions I will ask. Back to your interview question, what do you ask? Moments like that. Tell me about a time. What happens when? How do you approach these types of situations? And if teachers are having, so if teachers have a hard time, it's really starting in those moments and kind of building from there. So is it?
What do you mean having a hard time being able to adapt to that new
way
of looking instead of just responding and trying to fix it real quick?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then if they're having a hard time, then
recognizing what is that moment?
Mm-hmm.
Is this based on experience or lack of experience? Is it based on, as I learned, based on how I grew up? I had to really,
tell me about it.
Really adjust how I looked at what I would consider rude, and think back, okay, what does this really mean? Why? And then I would talk with the teacher. I would have the teacher, again, follow that same step. Let's talk with another mentor teacher, someone who's been here a long time, to make it interesting and educational for the whole group. I would do kind of like you do in business school. We would take a case study. So I would pull a situation, and as a team, say, here is the situation. How would you approach this?
To the team.
And we could have small group discussions or a larger discussion. Because there's so much strength in our team and so many background experiences that then you're kind of like crowdsourcing ideas.
Right.
And so, that business school approach of case studies is so powerful because there's no right answer.
And so you come from a background of that. See, you come from a background of that too, which makes your experience so unique compared to other, let's say, people just have been through the, education system all the way through. You had that, got out of it, went into the business aspect of it, administrative part of it, then came right back to it again, where your real love is. So I think that helped to fortify you because you saw some things you could bring back into it, which they were going to anyway, I guess. They saw that it worked in business, it can work in schooling too, in education.
Yeah, and I think it helps. That's where I look at, I'm able to step back and say it's not just the teacher. In that situation that you said, okay, if a teacher's having problems, what are you going to do? I was like, well, maybe it's the teacher, but maybe it could be something else.
Time restraints.
So I'll step back and look at, okay, what are all of the elements that contribute to this situation? What are the pressure points? What are the expectations? What is the product or outcome? What is the service component? What is that interaction? And then start to analyze. And when you do that, you look at a situation so differently than, oh, this is a teacher-student relationship. No, I mean, yes, there is the relationship component, but there's a lot of elements that shape that environment and experience. And a lot of that I have responsibility for. Or parents have responsibility for, or colleagues. And so how do we start to look at all of those elements, bring those people in, and shift and adjust to make it the best experience possible for a child?
Christy, it sounds to me like you have to, in your position, be very, very aware of your emotions and when you're becoming emotional about it and when you need to not be so emotional about it. because emotions tend to lead all of us.
Yeah.
And everything. So you tend to use your, it sounds like you use your emotions to settle yourself, take a step back, and be more analytical about it. And then put the emotions in when it's necessary to praise someone or to, that's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
When you're trying to praise them and try to leave the harshness away, but I'll praise this and look at how you're developing and how you've got it now. And instead of, no, don't, which is so easy, because most people are raised, unfortunately, we're raised with the no, stop, don't. So it's easy for us to regurgitate that right back out.
Yeah.
So it takes time, and that's why I admire what you're doing. It takes time, it takes thought, and it takes a love.
It really takes a love. There's a lot of emotion, there's a lot of emotional connection in what we do. You have to love the kids, and you have to love being with the kids. And I think the emotions that you have to suppress or really understand are, where are those, what are those moments of frustration, and what is it that's causing the frustration?
You mean within yourself?
Within, yeah.
Right, okay, right. Yeah, so that's what you have to suppress.
That's what you have
exactly,
to suppress
exactly.
And also understand.
Right.
And then look out and go, okay, is there a way to adjust, fix, correct, change? Right. And I think in education, we have so many external pressures that it's very, it can be very easy to lose the ability to have that joy and love, because there's so many things that are needed and required. Mm. And it's how we grew up, right?
That's true.
We grew up with getting a straight line, and whole class is going to get punished because someone was talking.
Ooh,
didn't you love that one?
And don't let it be you as the person who's they're, you know, causing this punishment for everybody else. I've been there. Christy, before I end this podcast, I love what you're saying, because it makes me think, because I found my why, and I think that's what all teachers try to look for. Why do I do this? Why is it that if someone took it away from me, I have no reason to do anything else anymore? Because I know what I'm good at doing, and I know what I enjoy doing. I know what I get satisfaction of working with. For me, when I work with smaller kids, and I enjoy that, and I enjoy working with older kids, but for a physical aspect, because my vehicle being gymnastics, but that's not the product. The product is self-confidence. That's what I want them to come out with, that they can use for the rest of their lives, not the gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they have that confidence, they can do gymnastics anytime for the rest of their lives, as I've done. I think it's being able to impress upon this slate that hasn't been barely touched, that represents so much of their life at that time. And I always feel privileged and honored when schools and parents allow me to do that. That makes me feel good. Before I end this podcast, I want to ask you a question. If you could go back in time, knowing what you know now, and meet the younger Christy and give her advice, what advice would you give her, and how old would you be?
I guess I'm very lucky and privileged. I'm at a point where I really love what I do, and I have loved my life. And I don't think I would be here if I hadn't had all those experiences. So I don't know that I would change anything or accelerate anything. Coming on this podcast, I think one thing I would tell my younger self is lean into discomfort a little faster or a little quicker. I mean, it took me a year to come back, right?
It did.
Because I don't like seeing myself on film, and I always listen to something I've said, and that inner voice is saying, oh, you should have said it this way or differently. And so this was uncomfortable. And earlier in life also, I was like, oh gosh, that's a little too uncomfortable. Let me do it this way or another way. And so I would say the advice I would give is, if something is uncomfortable, learn about yourself. Why is it uncomfortable? and dig into it a little deeper. Explore. You might find that it's not something you want to do anyhow, or you don't want to repeat again, but you might discover something new and different about yourself, as opposed to, I think, like this podcast, which took me a year of just like, no, Lance, I'm not going to come on. So that's kind of why I came back on, to say, okay, I'm going to face this. Thanks, Lance.
Thank
love talking
so
to you.
Thank you so much. I want to thank all of you for watching or listening to this podcast. Make sure you always remember, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.